From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. The country's largest Protestant denomination is facing an explosive new report about sex abuse in the church. It found that leaders in the Southern Baptist Convention stonewalled and denigrated victims, kept a secret list of known abusers, including pastors who were protected over the last 20 years. This is an ancient history. The report calls for dramatic changes, and it comes 1 month before Southern Baptists meet. Kate Shell is senior news editor for Christianity Today. Kate, you've been covering sex abuse in the Southern Baptist Church for years. We remember that first bombshell when just last summer the delegates representing almost, 14 million members voted to commission this independent report. 300 pages long, a warning, this might be disturbing for some, but what are the charges?
So in this report, they found out that top leaders in the Southern Baptist Convention, the people who are in charge of running the day-to-day business of the denomination, were heavily informed by their own lawyers and were moving to protect the church against lawsuits rather than helping victims. So they declined to act again and again when reports were made directly to them, and when people were calling for reform, that they were told to say nothing and do nothing. And so these are people who were taking phone calls and meeting with victims, and then afterwards, behind their backs and sometimes to their faces, insulting them, inscribing bad motives to them, taking them as kind of the enemy who are trying to distract them from the evangelistic mission of the church. And so rather than meeting these vulnerable, in many cases, women who had been abused as teenagers repeatedly, had credible allegations, and in some cases had criminal charges against their offenders, that they were not being met with any sort of care, but were being ignored and called the enemy, and sometimes even called, part of a satanic plan was right. One of the top attorneys had said about them.
Yeah, this is an influential executive committee member who said this was a satanic scheme and referred to one survivor of abuse as the devil. They were also told they were people with no integrity. How are some of these survivors reacting?
For survivors, I think it's a hard report to read through because a lot of these things are things that they've known all along and that they've tried to warn leaders within the Southern Baptist Convention, pastors, the general public to say, yeah, this is exactly what we told you was happening. The worst of what we said was true. So for them, it's really hard for them to be proven right after all these years when they said, you know, you could have believed us earlier, and if you would have, lives would have been saved, that there are so many more people in Southern Baptist churches who have had to endure abuse themselves because of pastors being allowed to go from church to church and not being penalized or called out or kept from continuing to hold positions of authority.
Right. And again, this report is only the last 20 years. What about churchgoers? This is, you know, in large part a conservative congregation. You've called this a sackcloth and ashes moment. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think for a lot of churchgoers, if you're a Southern Baptist, you've known for at least the last 3 or 4 years that this is an issue in your denomination. But the biggest thing I've heard is, we didn't know it was this bad. And I've seen multiple people reference the biblical idea of sackcloth and ashes, which designated a posture of mourning. There's a deep regret in knowing how badly things were for people who should have received compassion and care and healing and restoration and restitution, that those people were actually further hurt by the response of the denomination. And now I think they're trying to prepare these next few weeks before the annual meeting of what are we going to do to make a really meaningful response, not the minimum step, to really do something that I think will forever change the trajectory of the denomination.
Well, but you can see in many of the emails that many of the church leaders felt that they didn't have any legal right to pursue any of these cases because each of the something like 40,000 congregations affiliated with the Southern Baptist Convention is autonomous. This is what they said. So they'd get into legal trouble. That's probably not true, but what is it that they can do?
in the past, they've used the church structure of the Southern Baptist Convention, that independence, to block different moves for reform, different efforts to do more for survivors and do more to publicize individual leaders who have been accused of being offenders and have then disqualified themselves from the pulpit. So I think that we're going to see bolder moves be proposed and a greater willingness to compromise or work within the way the denomination is, rather than let that be a barrier to actually responding.
Kate Shelnut, senior news editor for Christianity Today, about the explosive new report detailing extensive abuse over the past 20 years in the Southern Baptist Convention. Kate, thank you.
Thank you.
Georgia, tomorrow's primary, will send a strong signal on former President Trump's influence over the Republican Party. In the GOP primary for governor, he is backing former Senator David Perdue, who is way behind the incumbent Brian Kemp. Trump has also endorsed an election denier in a tight race for Secretary of State. That's the person who oversees elections. There's also a Senate race on the ballot, and Democrats are watching Stacey Abrams' power to get people to the polls. Recall President Biden won Georgia by a mere 11,000 votes 2 years ago. With us now from Atlanta is Rahul Bali, following all this for member station WABE. Rahul, Governor Kemp has a lot of big-name Republicans backing him, with the notable exception of Donald Trump. Seems like that may be enough. He has a big lead over David Perdue.
He does, and we've been watching those numbers. And here's the important number that people need to know. 50%. In the state of Georgia, you have to get 50% of the vote to avoid a runoff. And that's really okay. Going to be the magic number, not the margin or anything else. That's what we're going to be watching for. As for who's supporting and who's campaigning, today is about the last White House. Former President Donald Trump is going to hold a telephone rally for David Perdue this evening, while former Vice President Mike Pence is going to rally here in Atlanta this evening for the current governor and the incumbent, Brian Kemp.
Mm. Oh, wow. Now, on the campaign trail, you spoke to a voter named Lee in Commerce, Georgia, who notes that Trump continues to hammer on election fraud charges, which are false.
Here's the thing. The vast majority of Republican and conservative voters I talked to believe something happened, whether the election was completely stolen or there were problems or what. They believe something happened. But then what happens next? You have some voters who they want to take it out on the governor, the Secretary of State race you mentioned. Even the Attorney General's race has come up. But then you have other voters like Lee, who didn't give his last name. He's from Commerce, Georgia. He's a Trump supporter, but he's really, really worried about what's going to happen in November.
I'm afraid if you keep bringing it up, you're going to turn off a segment of our Republican conservative voters. I think that they might not come back and vote, you know, if it just keeps on and on. It was a fraud. You know, we need to talk issues.
Scott, Rahul, why this is important.
Is it your sense? Oh, sorry to jump in. Is your sense that Lee represents a lot of Georgia voters?
I would say a large percentage. Because you have a mix of voters. You have some voters who they're not going to vote for anybody who's not Trump endorsed. That's a small percentage. Then the majority of voters I talk to, it's a mix. They may vote for the incumbent governor, Brian Kemp, but then they may vote for some Trump endorsed candidates. There are some Trump endorsed candidates that they don't even like. They're like, I love Donald Trump, but you know what? I'm not going to support his endorsed candidate. The Trump endorsement is not automatic. I think that's the big takeaway from talking to voters. Just because Donald Trump endorsed someone, even Trump supporters, the most ardent ones, don't automatically mean that they're going to vote for that person.
Okay. On the other side of the ballot in the gubernatorial primary is Democrat Stacey Abrams. She's unopposed, which would set up a rematch against Kemp. Remind us what happened back in 2018. She never conceded, right?
Yeah, she was raising issues, you know, that were there problems, you know, around voting, different from what happened in 2020, but it was a close race. And in the end, Brian Kemp was elected, and part of that was powered by the endorsement of former President Trump.
Okay, the Secretary of State race, many of us remember the name Brad Raffensperger. He has been in that job and in that infamous phone call with President Trump that went public. He refused to find more votes that the president was requesting. He's in a close race, yeah?
Absolutely. There are four candidates in that race. There are three There are three challengers, and those three challengers are all repeating some level of the false claims around the 2020 elections, led by the current congressman, Jody Heiss, and that's what he's centering his campaign around. And again, back to what I said earlier, you got to get 50% of the vote to avoid a runoff. That race looks like it is heading to a runoff between Raffensperger and Jody Heiss.
Okay, and finally, on the Senate race, incumbent Democrat Raphael Warnock, Herschel Walker on the GOP side, are they likely to come up against each other in the general election?
That's what it's looking like. Raphael Warnock has minor opposition. Herschel Walker has been leading in the polls the whole way. And what this comes down to, this may be the seat that decides control of the U.S. Senate.
Important state, Rahul Bali is politics reporter for WABE in Georgia. Thanks so much.
Great to be on.
Recently, I was at my market and thought I saw behind her mask my neighbor Emma. But I am not Emma, the woman chirped. Outside, we fell in step. She asked questions, so many questions. Where do you work? In her lilting Russian accent.
Where do you work? What do you do? My just usual questions. This is my dream work was journalism. And my urgency to communicate to people and ask them about their life, it enriched my life. This is explanation. That's it. But when I heard Rabin and NPR.
Well, turns out Galina Lambersky had been trying to reach me to tell her story, and what a story it is. She grew up in the Soviet Union, so she couldn't be a journalist. Her father, Felix Lambersky, was a noted Jewish Ukrainian artist. Stalin's regime offered him riches to paint sunny Soviet propaganda. Instead, he painted scenes from the Nazi Holocaust in Ukraine or exhausted Russian coal workers. After he died, Galina moved her mother, her daughter from a marriage to a man she left after he became a Soviet informant, and all her father's paintings to a crammed apartment. And although an engineer, she took a job managing hair salons, where another KGB informant turned her in on a phony charge, and she was sent to a labor camp, leaving young Elena to strangers. The family and the paintings made it out of the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Galina and Elena are settled around Boston. Elena recently published their breathtaking memoir, Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour. When we visited, she described the Soviet apartment building she grew up in on the outskirts of Leningrad, now St. Petersburg.
The recently built neighborhoods that all look the same. Russia, in Ukraine.
We're seeing some of them in Ukraine right now being bombed.
And every time I see those buildings bombed in Ukraine, I feel that my old neighborhood is coming down. The buildings were not very beautiful, but we spent a lot of time outdoors in the forest. I remember I have this tactile visual memories of raisin sap on the bark of the pine trees. And when we first moved in, people brought cups of sugar to Visha's sweet life.
It's also a very gray existence. Gray rain, gray shawl. At one point you write, my gray heart.
So yes, but when the sun comes out and you see these blue veins of the sky, you feel this burst of gratitude. There's a lot of beauty in small things that I remember. Poplar trees blooming in May, and we would play with this little pendants that fall from the branches.
One of the bursts of color and of life is your mother. You write, your mother would sail in the door on a blustering wind full of ideas and plans. She was smart, good at math, an engineer, someone who could write poetry, could start conversations with strangers in the street, and they will invite her home. Yes. Galina, were you aware growing up that your father had rejected the Stalinist regime offer of fame and fortune to do?
Not immediately, but a little bit older, yes. I was very proud of him, yes. He rejected this because his vision of art was freedom.
But Galina, everything changes. Your father dies. I'm really fast-forwarding here, but you want to leave the Soviet Union. The way I understand it, Elena, Soviet Jews were allowed, but it came with a price.
So it was a time of Iron Curtain, and the government did everything they could not to allow people to leave, because it burst this idea that Soviet life is good. Some of us could leave with a permission, but as soon as you applied, you became the enemy and you were blacklisted. In elementary school, our teacher was telling our class children, people who want to leave our Soviet Union, our motherland, are traitors. And I felt she was talking to me. I loved my country, but I wanted to be with my mother and with my grandmother.
Yeah. Your grandmother does leave with the painting. She comes to the United States. You both, Galina and Elena, you are just about to get out. Galina, you were framed. And suddenly, you're arrested, taken away on a trumped-up charge. Elena, you come home from school one day, and there are the Soviet police tearing apart your apartment. This is heart-clasping. Talk about that time, 1981. Your mother goes to trial and doesn't come home.
I was 11. I have to tell you that the very first talk that I gave after this book, I wanted to read that first chapter, and I couldn't. And this is 40 years after this happened.
Because why? Tell us.
It's just... For 30 years, we did not talk about our story. When our airplane was taking off from Leningrad, my mother and I made the decision not to talk about our past. We did not want to bring Russia, the repressions, the ugliness of it into our new life. And my hope was that one day I will wake up and it's not there. And when we started writing, all these memories were as if everything happened just yesterday. And when I imagined writing, I thought that I will write an angry expose of the KGB. And I was surprised to see all these memories of my early childhood, the people who were kind, the foster families that took me in. But of course, at that time, I couldn't feel that gratitude, and I only wanted to be with my mother.
And then first a prison, then a labor camp, open toilets and rancid grains and the oatmeal you had to eat every day. You're nodding.
The cold of the winter, and you have to go to the toilet. It was awful. I couldn't go for a month. And then I started to do this. The same with the porridge, that smell, and was gray color. Awful. I couldn't eat it. And then I started to eat.
I think that when women are put to prison, dissidents, refuseniks, women had this additional burden. My mother writes about this sticky bread that felt like clay. And she would see women shaping, fashioning this bread into little toys, little wee foxes, little bears. And my mother would think, here are these women making toys, and their children are alone.
Galina, it sounds as if the lifeline was your being able to at least try to parent your daughter through your letters. I want you to read a portion of one of the letters.
My little bird, original is written with I and not with E, as you have it. Remember this. Neighbors with an H. My little kitten, you are so illiterate. It is frightening.
You're giving her a lesson on spelling. Here's another one that Elena has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My beloved, precious girl, I would never laugh at you, especially when you are not with me. Always remember this. Everything that you find serious, it is serious to me 100-fold. And what is hurtful is my tragedy. I have little interest in things related to my own person, but each one of your tears is my sobbing.
Sobbing, yeah.
Your smile is my laughter.
Alina, what was it like to get those?
What I remember is that we were together apart, but I never felt alone. When I reread those letters, I felt this overwhelming power, her strength, and the strength that she has given me from prison. And even now that I am in my 50s, I realize that I live my life with the advice that she has given me in these letters.
I didn't think about future at that point. My goal was to survive, to fight, to come back to my daughter.
Galina Lembersky. After she was released from a Soviet labor camp, she took a job as a janitor to secure state housing for Alina until they could leave for the U.S. Their new memoir is Like a Drop of Ink in a Downpour. We're going to visit more with the Lemberskys down the road, but right now, some of Felix Lembersky's paintings and an excerpt from the book are at hereandnow.org. And we leave you with Alina playfully reading a letter her mother wrote her from that labor camp 40 years ago.
I received your story about the painting, about the story. It is bad, Alina. Really bad. You ruined the magnificent description of the sand in the sea with the absence of any interest in your protagonist. You took an easy route out and did not take time to think. You did it ad hoc, ship and pray once again. Drivel, pure shame.
Galina's laughing.
I am so sorry we can't talk face to face, or I tell you so much more. No, my love, foster self-criticism toward everything you do, or you will never improve.
And Alina says they are not victims, they are victors. The National Interagency Fire Center is monitoring 11 large wildfires burning right now in the West, and it's still spring. And throughout the region, officials are taking steps to prepare for a more severe wildfire season. To reduce the risk, specialists in Nevada are turning to an animal for some help. Caleb Radel of the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
It's a warm spring morning in Carson City, Nevada. Georgia Vasey, the city's natural resource specialist, is hiking up a trail in the western side of town.
This is the time when all of a sudden you're like, wow, Nevada's not just like brown, you know, and dry. It's like looks kind of green, like from a distance, but it's all green up of all the grasses. And that's
from a distance, you can see the green hillside is painted in a swath of white that appears to be moving. As you get closer, before you can clearly see what's covering the hill, you clearly hear them. Up close, the sheep look like they're just happily chomping on grass. But Vasey says they're doing much more.
What happens after fires is that you'll get this, like, flush of fine fuels. Sheep graze the grass to hopefully, like, reduce those fine fuels.
The main one is cheatgrass. It's an invasive species that spreads quickly and is highly flammable. And these sheep aren't shy about eating it. Vasey says each one can eat about 5 pounds a day. In all, there are 1,400 sheep in two flocks that mow down cheatgrass from sunrise to sunset over the course of a month and a half.
We're not going to prevent fires. This place will always burn. But what we can see is that areas that have been grazed and then we get a fire again, the intensity of the fires is much, much less, and they're much more manageable for the fire department.
Getting rid of the grasses and brush that fuel wildfires is a critical part of managing western lands. Usually it's done by a prescribed burn, but the use of sheep, goats, and cattle is becoming more common, especially in California. Dan Makin is a livestock and natural resources advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension. He studies how grazing can impact wildfire fuels.
It's really an effective way to manage the fuel profile. So we're removing the flammable material, but we're also able to really modify that fuel structure so that we don't have the amount of oxygen that we would have around standing untreated fuel.
This is the 16th year in a row that Carson City has used SHEEP to reduce wildfire risks. The program was sparked after the 2004 Waterfall Fire burned more than 8,000 acres and destroyed 18 homes in the area. And now that the entire West is in a mega drought, Vasey says the fuel grazing sheep are more important than ever. She says the city also keeps track of what stages the grasses are in and how much is eaten each year. In grazing, sometimes less is more.
If we're overdoing it, if it was overgrazed, and that would allow us to, you know, pump the brakes and say, like, hey, this year maybe you're going to have to avoid this area for the plants to have a little bit more time to regenerate.
The program comes at no cost to Carson City, which uses sheep from a century-old ranch.
We give him land for him to be able to graze his animals, and then in the end we get the benefit of getting this, like, you know, free fuels management.
It's a partnership that Vasey says Carson City is especially thankful for, as wildfire seasons grow longer and more intense due to climate change. For Here and Now, I'm Caleb Bradle.
And a quick note, some hopeful news for parents with young kids. Today, Pfizer and BioNTech announced that a third pediatric dose of their COVID vaccine triggered a strong positive response in kids from 6 months to under 5 years old. Now, an early analysis found the vaccine's about 80% effective at preventing symptomatic COVID. These vaccine doses are one-tenth the size of the adult dose, and the company say they appear to be as safe as the placebo. They plan to submit the data to the Food and Drug Administration next week. The FDA is scheduled to discuss vaccines for this age group on June 15th. Couldn't come fast enough for a lot of parents, so we'll keep an eye on it.
The James Beard Award Ceremony returns in person next month after being canceled for 2 years during the pandemic. That's a big moment for foodies and for people in the restaurant industry who work hard to earn a Beard Award, or even the recognition that comes with being nominated. One of the semifinalists for Outstanding Chef is a tortilla purist from El Paso, Texas. He makes them from scratch for every order. Emiliano Morentes is the chef and co-owner of the restaurant Alemi in downtown El Paso, and he joins us. Emiliano, welcome to Here and Now, and congratulations on your nomination for Outstanding Chef.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this not only puts your restaurant on the map, it makes you a big dot on the food map. Did you have any idea this was coming?
I did not. I did not have any idea. I was really surprised the morning I found out. A friend of mine from San Antonio sent me a congratulations, and at first I wasn't sure why. I had to look it up.
Which gives you, you know, a lot of attention, a platform in a way. What do you want to do with this attention?
I would say mostly I'm happy for my city and for the recognition, not just for myself, but so that other aspiring chefs from the city of El Paso, you know, end up choosing to stay rather than to leave. We do have a lot of young professionals that, you know, leave El Paso for better opportunities. Mm. And especially in the culinary field, there's not as much as you would say like New York City or in Chicago or Austin.
Yeah, now your restaurant, LME, is not very big. I read 8 tables and 8 stools. And you have said you want to bring something to El Paso that was not available. What do you mean?
So El Paso, we're in a border town. Flour tortillas are king. I mean, I grew up eating burritos. And the corn tortilla represented something else to us. It was more a roots, a connection to where we come from. Even though I was born here in El Paso, my parents are from Mexico. I would say that that's our roots to Mexico. But in another way I would see it is that to make a tortilla, it's a process, it's an ancient process, and it's not really practiced as much as I believe it should be. I understand why it's pretty hard. So that's pretty much what we wanted to do, is to just focus on the quality of a tortilla. So we just have masa ready, and we don't make it until you order your taco or you order your dish or whatever is it that you're going to
eat. Oh, is that right? So, okay. You were featured on the Hulu show Taste the Nation, and it shows you making your tortillas by scratch. And the big word that you use is nixtamalization. What is that?
So that's the process of cooking the corn in an alkaline solution. I mean, in Spanish, it's called cal. All it is calcium hydroxide. And as you let it sit in that same solution, it absorbs a lot of calcium, a lot of other minerals and good vitamins for the body. It turns the, like a whole grain, but it also softens the grain. It also breaks it down. So it's like an ancient chemical process that I'm not sure how it was discovered, probably accidentally, but you'll be able to grind it into a masa.
That's kind of a paste after it comes out of the grinder, yeah?
Yes, and what we make is that we make a really soft and gooey masa. Once we have the masa, with my hands, I just knead it. I knead it for like 5 to 10 minutes. A lot of this is by feel.
And so when I show up at your restaurant and I order a taco or two, you're going to take this the paste, as it were, and then put it in the press and press it flat and cook it after I get there. Is that the idea?
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, you're going to have the freshest tortilla you could have. To us, I think it's an experience when, you know, it's made fresh for you.
So on the Hulu show Taste the Nation, you make host Padma Lakshmi an El Campesino taco that you serve. Yes. And here she is talking about it.
The mushrooms are savory, the beans are creamy, cheese is oozy and crunchy and salty. Mmm! This alone is reason to come to El Paso. It's so delicious.
Thank you.
You're a good man.
And wow. Seeing this taco is oh my goodness. So describe it for us. Take a little time.
So I just wanted to make a vegetarian taco the way I eat pretty much. And I wanted to use ingredients that we could, you know, obtain all year long. And I just gathered all the components that I really like. You know, I like grilled eggplant. That's just the flavor I really like. Mushrooms, another component. And how do you make mushrooms the creamiest and the best? I mean, just poach them in oil. And I like to put beans. I like to add beans to some of my tacos, especially if it's a vegetarian taco. I think it just tastes amazing. And the cheese just adds another richness to the whole taco. So that's kind of like just trying to see how can I get a really good vegetarian taco that's going to be filling and is going to be great. And people are just going to keep wanting.
Now, you of all people, a restaurant proprietor, know what this pandemic means to small business. How's it going for you and your wife? How have you adapted?
We've adapted in so many ways. We've changed and we continue to change. We were never really a to-go restaurant, but now we sell a lot more to-go. We've changed our hours. We've changed our pricing. I mean, I could say that there's some positive changes that we made, but they all come from just trying to adapt and trying to figure out this new normal for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, inflation, right? We have more evidence that it's more than 8% measured annually. How does that impact you?
Yeah, it's been a little hard. You know, I see price before it was seasonal price changes. Now it's weekly price changes and sometimes daily price changes. I try to keep up with what's going on globally, you know, such as the issues with avocados. We try not to use a lot of the big proteins. I mean, we do use beef, we do use pork, but we use very little chicken. We use a lot of vegetables. We use duck, we use rabbit. We try to expand our variety of what we use just so that we're not affected. But yeah, I mean, it's been crazy to just try to manage everything.
Yeah. And finally, Emiliano, you're in the border town of El Paso. And as you're describing, you've spent much of your life crossing over to Juarez in Mexico and back, and your food tries to represent your slice of the world. And yet, I don't have to tell you about the politics in this country, how immigrants, how the border, Mexicans in particular can be talked about in the ugliest way. Anything you want to say or do or make to express yourself, express your food in this moment?
I'm not sure how to answer that, but I would say that it would be a connection to who we are. Because if you think about Juarez, it's really north. It's really far from the interior of Mexico. And then if you think about El Paso, it's really far from the rest of Texas and from the center of the United States. So I would say we're kind of like our own community here. You know, I remember my childhood, it was like nothing going back and forth. Even as a teenager, I would go back and forth with just an ID. Mm. So it was more of a big community rather than what it is now, which is two cities that are heavily separated by a wall and by, you know, politics, obviously. And I would like people to come to El Paso and see why we're one of the safest cities. And it's more so because we are a big community, and most of us come from immigrant parents. Some of us are first generation, some of us are, you know, third, fourth generation. But that's what I would like to say about that.
Emiliano Marentes is chef and co-owner of the restaurant Alemi in El Paso, Texas, and he's been nominated as a semifinalist for the James Beard Award for Outstanding Chef. Congratulations, Emiliano, and thanks for the time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In Ukraine today, a court handed down the first war crime sentence of the conflict. Judges gave a life sentence to a 21-year-old Russian sergeant for shooting and killing an unarmed Ukrainian man who was 62. NPR's Greg Myrie joins us now from Kyiv, where he has been covering this case. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Scott.
I understand life in prison was the most severe possible sentence in this case. Tell us what this sergeant is convicted of doing and how the judges spoke about it today.
Right. This young Russian soldier is named Vadim Shishamarin, and the judges listened to his case last week, and today was the sentencing. He pleaded guilty a few days ago to shooting and killing a 62-year-old unarmed Ukrainian man just a few days into the war back in February. And there were concerns about whether this was in some way not going to be a full or fair trial, but the prosecution presented very compelling evidence. They said that this soldier, along with others, were captured just a day after this killing back in February. Another Russian soldier who was captured testified against Shishamarin, said he pulled the trigger, and a friend of the dead Ukrainian man witnessed the shooting and testified. The widow testified. There was very strong evidence in the case.
And who represented this Russian soldier?
There was a Ukrainian attorney who represented Shishamarin. He said that he shouldn't be convicted or he should get a light sentence because he was told to do this. They saw this man, this Ukrainian man, talking on a phone, and the Russian soldiers thought he might be revealing their position. So they told Shishamarin to shoot him. And at first he objected, but they kept shouting at him, saying, shoot him, shoot him, shoot him, or we could all be in danger. And so then Shishamarin did fire some rounds and did kill him instantly in a small village in northeastern Ukraine.
This sentence, Greg, is life in prison, but is there any possibility that he could be part of some soldier swap?
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. The Russians already are talking about putting on their own war crimes trial. They're making unfounded claims against some of these fighters who were at the steel plant in Mariupol. I think as you negotiate the end of this war, which may be way, way into the future, prisoner exchanges will be talked about. This case could certainly be one of those cases that the two sides will discuss at some future point.
Is there any signal here for how Ukrainian prosecutors will pursue future war crimes trials? I guess we should note the obvious. The war is still going.
Yeah, and of course, that is highly unusual. The tradition is to do it after the war is over. But Ukraine says it's already documented more than 11,000 possible Russian war crimes. They say they want to investigate while the evidence is still fresh and witnesses can be located rather than waiting years and trying to reconstruct the cases afterwards. There's one other case they're prosecuting at the moment that involves two Russian soldiers accused of shelling civilian areas on purpose. They say they've identified more than 40 Russian soldiers they consider suspects, but I think the big challenge is going to be, can they capture them?
All right. Also today, Ukrainian President Zelensky spoke to the World Economic Forum, this gathering of the global elite in Davos, Switzerland. What did he tell them?
Right. So as he spoke to the global business elite, he really was stressing an economic message. He talked about what he said was the need to keep punishing Russia with sanctions and economic punitive measures, and to, on the other hand, help Ukraine with financial assistance. One of the emerging issues here is Ukrainian agriculture exports, grain exports in particular. Ukraine is one of the world's larger farming nations. It depends heavily on the export of wheat and barley and other crops. But Russia is currently blocking Ukraine's largest port down in Odessa with its warships in the Black Sea. It's not harvesting season just yet, but we can see this happening, and this is obviously not only critical to Ukraine's economy, but it's a global problem, especially for many developing countries that depend on imports from Ukraine.
Over the weekend, President Zelensky said 50 to 100 Ukrainian troops are dying daily in the fighting in the east. That's where the fighting is the heaviest. That sounds notable, as we haven't received a lot of official news on casualties, have we?
Yes, Scott, that's exactly right. It sort of came out indirectly. A journalist asked him about this petition. Some Ukrainian men are petitioning to be allowed to leave the country, while the current rules in the country are all men up to the age of 60 must make themselves eligible for military service. And Zelensky gave a rather pointed response to this question. He said, maybe this petition shouldn't be sent to him. Maybe it should go to the parents whose sons have died in the fighting. And then he sort of just tossed out there that 50 to 100 Ukrainians are dying in the fighting every day. Now, the death toll for troops on both sides is certainly in the thousands, but neither side has been giving figures recently. This was sort of a glimpse of how intense that fighting is in eastern Ukraine.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Kyiv. Greg, thanks so much. Stay safe.
My pleasure, Scott.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.